Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health policy, health innovation and technology, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Sushmita Patti, Division Chief of Primary Care Pediatrics at Stony Brook Children's Hospital and Chief Medical Program Advisor for the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook. She talks about their successful workshops using actors training and seasoned journalists to teach scientists and medical professionals how to better communicate their scientific knowledge. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor at factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or on iTunes, SoundCloud, or ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Sushmita Patti, Division Chief of Primary Care Pediatrics at Stony Brook and Medical Program Advisor for the Alan Alda Center on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sushmita Patti, Division Chief of Primary Care Pediatrics at the Stony Brook Children's Hospital at Stony Brook University. She also serves as Chief Medical Program Advisor for the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. Prior to that, Dr. Patti was on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she co-founded Policy Lab, a child health services research center. She's the recipient of the Healthcare Delivery Award for her Keeping Families Healthy Community Health Worker Intervention. Dr. Patti earned her bachelor's in biochemical science from Harvard University, her MD from the University of Connecticut, and a master's of public health from Columbia University. Dr. Patti, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, this is sort of an interesting time in healthcare. We're in this era of evidence-based scientific knowledge, and we see it under attack in so many different sectors, whether it's the growing resistance that we've seen on vaccinations or the denial of evidence of climate change. And strangely to the rescue comes the legendary American actor Alan Alda, who's known for his role in the hit TV series MASH. He's also hosted a science show on PBS. And it was interesting, Margaret, we've heard him talk about
Absolutely.
This. Yeah. He interviewed many scientists from the show, and he discovered that they could really use some coaching to better share their knowledge with the public. So he founded the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook, where you serve as Chief Medical Program Advisor. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners about the genesis of the program and how it utilizes seasoned journalists and helps scientists improve their communicating skills.
So it really came out of Alan's experience in both those arenas, in acting and also in hosting the show, which was called Scientific American Frontiers on PBS. And he really found that in working with folks who were working on really complicated scientific issues, that having conversations with them where he was using improvisational exercises to help them get more clear and vivid in their communication, it worked. And so that was the genesis of the center. And he found that it improved not just verbal communication, also nonverbal communication. And now we've trained, you know, I think it's up to 14,000 folks in this method. The way that it works is we use improvisational facilitators, many folks who have a theater background, to provide the training. And then the seasoned journalists that are involved, scientists, medical professionals on the team, they really help develop the way that these offerings are put together, and then also on the evaluation side to see is what we're doing working. So it's very much a team approach, and we're really proud of what we have to offer.
Well, Dr. Patti, that is so interesting. And you know, I was thinking as you were speaking, we think a lot about translational science. We're really talking about getting people to understand here. The consequences of not communicating effectively are pretty extreme, and the ability to communicate effectively has been focused on in the education and training of scientists and clinicians in a clinical sense, perhaps, but not in this larger scale. Tell me a little bit about what you've seen in terms of transformation as these scientists learn to communicate more effectively. Maybe share a story.
And I'm happy to share some stories. I've been with the center now since January of 18. And we started actually prior to that having trainings at Stony Brook Medicine with groups of healthcare professionals. It was nurses, attending physicians, trainees, dietary aides, respiratory therapists. And they were led by, again, an improv facilitator from the center and a healthcare professional, often myself. And we ran through these trainings over the course of about a year with about 170 folks. And afterward, we heard from the nursing leadership about how folks on the floors in the hospital, when they made a sort of mistake in communication, maybe they were a little too abrupt, they would do a thing that we talk about, which we call ta-da. And ta-da is sort of that thing that you see clowns do, you know, or when they, you know, after they, if they make a mistake, then they do a ta-da. And it's a way to quickly acknowledge that you made a mistake and move on. And so the nurses and the staff were ta-da-ing with each other when they made those mistakes. And it really has led to a positive change in the culture, in the way we communicate. It certainly has helped build the team communication as well. So that's just one story from Stony Brook Medicine about some of what we've done.
Well, I was just trying to think about my own kids. I've got four of them, and they are very much into instant communication. And I think they're expecting their healthcare providers to respond like their dad does or their mom does in terms of being there right at the moment. You know, I'm wondering if you could walk us through issues that today's providers are going to face with a whole new generation of people who are expecting to be able to access healthcare information in a totally different way. And I'm wondering how the ALDA method helps providers address this sea change.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. You know, I think our approach at the center has really to be thinking about what do folks really want and need from their healthcare team? And it really boils down to a lot of what folks want as a parent, but what folks want from leaders in general. And that's trust, compassion, stability. All of those things are things that people are looking for from their healthcare, quality care, well, you know, doing the right thing, the right treatment. But to do those other things, that's what really matters to folks when it comes to healthcare, to feel that they're being listened to. And so our trainings really focus on that because we're aiming to train the team to communicate better so that they can offer all of that. And that is, you know, really analogous to what's happened in other industries. So I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the janitor who was questioned at NASA. And they asked the janitor, "What do you do here?" And the janitor said, "I put people on the moon." And in healthcare, we want folks to be able to answer that no matter what role they play on the team, that when they're asked, what do? They take care of patients.
Well, Dr. Patti, I know in addition to your incredible work in communications, you're also a thought leader in care transformation and particularly improving health outcomes for pediatric patients and their families. And congratulations for this. You earned the Academic Pediatric Association's Healthcare Delivery Award for
Thank
a program
you.
That you developed called Keeping Families Healthy. This is a program that provides a community health worker to families who are at risk. And your thinking was that this allows you to make a much more accurate risk assessment of the social determinants, which ultimately lead to poor outcomes, by establishing a clinical presence or a clinical connection in the patient's homes. If you could talk with us a little bit about that program, and have you documented better outcomes?
You're absolutely right. That was the original thinking around the program. How do we really understand what challenges folks face? They go to the doctor, they get recommendations, they can't always follow through. And so this is a good neighbor whom we train, the community health worker, to go into the home, really talk with the family, understand their needs, their challenges, while also knowing what the doctor has in mind for the clinical care plan, and really help the family become self-sufficient in following those recommendations. So since 2011, We've done more than 10,000 visits with more than 1,400 families, and we found that folks who participate in the program, there's a 50% reduction in so-called preventable emergency room visits, mm-hmm. and a 16 to 20% increase in up-to-date vaccine status. So it works, and on the participant side, 99% of folks who participate in the program felt that it helped them. And then on the provider side, they are seeing improvements in the way that families are able to now follow the recommendations, everything from taking their asthma medications to just being able to get to appointments on time.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sushmita Patti, a division chief of primary care pediatrics at the Stony Brook Children's Hospital at Stony Brook University. She also serves as chief medical program advisor for the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. You know, I really like the sort of model of keeping families healthy. I know at our own health primary care organization, you know, team-based care is really the direction to go. And I loved your story about the NASA janitor. I think everybody on the team needs to know the goal that they're headed. It's such an exciting program. What are key elements of those practitioners and primary care team members who are listening in today that are key takeaways?
I mean, home visiting has been around for a lot of years, and I think what's made our program particularly successful, first of all, we start with the clinicians being the ones to make the referrals. So it's the doctor in the office seeing the patient, and they're like, you know, this patient seems like they might have trouble following up or doing what we've asked them to do. And they get a sense. And so we ask them to go with their gut, make a referral to us. And then the community health worker goes in and does a deeper dive and come up with ways to help the family follow those recommendations. So, you know, this is a strategy that can work not just for children, of course, for other populations, adult populations, certainly elder populations. And then I think, you know, for folks who are on a lot of medications, our community health workers are not clinically trained. So that's where you would think about maybe adding a nurse on top, someone that could talk with the family on the phone. And then I think, you know, the other piece that we've put into place that really helps it be successful is after the community health workers make a visit, there's a visit summary that goes back to the referring clinician so they know what's going on, just like you'd get a consult back from a specialist. So that allows the team to figure out, oh, let's tweak it a little bit. The community health worker can work on that. And then when everyone feels like the family's ready to fly solo, then we're done. And so I think those are some of the key pieces.
I want to pull it back to what goes on within the practices. You've been engaged in education and in research at Penn and now at Stony Brook and have a bird's eye view, I think, on the training of our healthcare workforce today and also our next generation that's coming up. What are you seeing that's different about the way we both train the next generation within the practices to a model of what we call high-performing team-based care? How do we actually train them to that and to interprofessional care? So easy to say, harder to do. And are you engaged in any research efforts to really show measurable changes in perhaps the what we call the quadruple aim around quality and cost and the satisfaction of everybody on that team?
You know, this is certainly we're not the only ones working on in this area. The National Academy of Medicine really recognizes some of the challenges we have in healthcare, lots of burnout. It's a real crisis for the workforce, and by building teamwork, we rekindle that joy in work. You know, most people go into healthcare because they want to help people. Training folks to work together in teams to communicate well, it really rekindles that joy. You know, a lot of the medical schools, nursing schools are all looking to train students together. The trainings we offer at the center absolutely do that as well, like the story I shared about what we've done at Stony Brook Medicine. And then, of course, we're evaluating it. And I'm sure some of the listeners may have read the literature about how patient-centered medical home recognition, how does that impact patient care? And it positively impacts, and we certainly are engaged in some of that research as well to look at, you know, team science and how what makes a high-functioning team, and then what's the downstream positive effect on patient care. So we're absolutely actively engaged in that work.
Dr. Patti, I wonder if you have any advice for the presidential candidates on how to effectively effectively communicate on health policy. And now I see every day somebody's jumping in. The Governor Hickenlooper announced one of many politicians who are jumping in. But, you know, we've got very contentious and divisive issues around health policy, about how we communicate about that to the populations. For those of us who are engaged in it, we're excited about it, but it's kind of a dry topic and it's kind of complicated. And I'm wondering, how do we shift the conversation about health policy discussion into a positive direction?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, most folks care about this. It affects their ability to get health care when they need it. So I think people are naturally interested in it. I think the challenge that we have in the discussions at the moment are, you know, generally the public and people behave as if healthcare is a right. It's funded as a privilege. And so, you know, I think that's the real question. You know, what healthcare services should everyone have? I think most folks would agree if you're in a car accident, you don't want to have to prove that you have the ability to pay for the surgery that you might need before you can get it. So that's, you know, that's one question. What about folks who get cancer? What about folks who are trying to get pregnant and then would like to take advantage of the in vitro fertilization techniques that we have? And then what are the downstream effects of that? In vitro fertilization results more likely in premature babies, children who may have other problems. Who's paying for all of that? What about end-of-life care? So these are, you know, really challenging questions. They're not ones that have just a scientific or evidence-based answer. They're ones that really speak to what are the values that our country wants to put forward. Where do we want to spend our money? What kinds of services in healthcare are we going to say everyone has the right to have?
We've been speaking today with Dr. Sushmita Patti, Division Chief of Primary Care Pediatrics at the Stony Brook Children's Hospital, and she is also the Chief Medical Program Advisor for the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. You can learn more about their work by going to aldacommunicationtraining.com or at stonybrookchildrens.org, and follow their work on Twitter at Alda Center. Dr. Patti, thank you so much for the work you do in advancing pediatric care and family care, in advancing the science of communicating science, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
There have been 6 measles outbreaks so far this year. 3 in New York and 1 each in Texas, Illinois, and Washington State. Darla Shine, the wife of Bill Shine, President Trump's Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications, made a series of false and misleading statements about measles and vaccines on Twitter. Shine said to, quote, bring back childhood diseases because, quote, they keep you healthy and fight cancer. Childhood diseases, of course, make people sick, not healthy. They also don't protect against cancer. While survivors gain immunity, the same effect can be achieved far more safely with vaccines. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that even with the best medical care, 1 to 2 of every 1,000 measles patients will die, and a quarter of patients are hospitalized. Before the measles vaccine was available in the U.S., an average of 450 people died every year. Shine cited news stories about a clinical trial at the Mayo Clinic to support her claim that measles can fight cancer. But the researchers weren't giving patients the measles to kill cancer cells. They were giving them a weakened version of the measles virus that's similar to the vaccine. Shine suggested that her children would not have lifelong immunity because they received the vaccine instead of becoming infected with measles as she did. Infection in some cases does result in stronger protection than vaccines provide, but experts say that extra protection doesn't outweigh the dangers of going unvaccinated. Schein also warned pregnant people not to get vaccines because of a lack of safety testing and approval from the Food and Drug Administration. It's true that the FDA hasn't licensed vaccines for use during pregnancy, but there is a large body of evidence to support the use of several vaccines. Schein falsely said that many of the kids in the ongoing Washington State measles outbreak had been vaccinated and called for the media, quote, to confirm 75% of those infected with measles in New York were fully vaccinated. The overwhelming majority of people in both outbreaks were not vaccinated. There are no documented cases of measles passing from one person to another because of vaccination. We don't typically analyze statements made by the spouses of political figures, but Schein's claims, if taken seriously, could be dangerous to public health. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When venture capitalist and Shark Tank co-host Mark Cuban decides to sink a couple of hundred thousands of dollars into your business idea, taking a very small percentage of the company in return, you're probably onto something. And that's what happened to Olivier Noel, a medical student and young geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania, when he appeared on the popular ABC show. Through his research and studies, Noel learned that no matter how many resources a clinical study has, it is still extremely difficult to get a large sample of participants to join in studies. There are many barriers to getting a good cross-section of study participants, especially ethnic diversity. So he thought, what if you could simplify the process, eliminate the barriers to research participation, and build up a rich DNA database for future research all at the same time? And he created DNA Simple because he wanted to make it, well, simple.
I was actually working out of the Institute of Personalized Medicine in Hershey. And one of the key problems that I saw there is that there was enough funding for really amazing research projects, but it ended up being a little bit of a chasing game. We couldn't build strong enough cohorts at first to be able to do some of the studies we wanted. Some of the patients we were looking for, it was taking a very long time for them to come. And every day it would be going down and talking to the genetic counselors and ask, you know, did we have patients with this background today? And so I ended up going to a genetics conference at Penn, actually. And the keynote speaker there was alluding to a similar problem. And one of the ways they were able to contact patients was through Facebook. And so through Facebook, they were able to connect with a number of patients all the way in India and organized the logistics to be able to get the samples. And really that stuck with me, and really when the sort of the light bulb went on, and I realized that that's something that we could use and leverage. So I wanted to sort of leverage the internet and particularly leverage social media to be able to build a national database where somebody did not need to be a patient to be able to participate in this research study.
All the participants have to do is to take a simple swab of the inside of the mouth, send it in, and wait to see if your specific DNA is of interest to researchers. Noel says that the company will make their DNA and disease data available to researchers, offering those researchers a much broader spectrum of study participants.
So one of the things we really wanted to do with DNA Simple is to allow for the possibility of doing longitudinal study so that you could continue keeping contact anonymously, obviously, with a particular donor. And you have the ability to collect samples now, collect samples in 6 months, which is very difficult to do if you're going to be in contact with a patient once.
And the study participants themselves receive a cash stipend for offering up their DNA to research.
So we ultimately provide a minimum of $50 every time somebody provides a saliva sample, which they could keep for themselves or donate it to a charity of their choice.
DNA Simple, a vetted database linking researchers with a broad array of participants to enhance lab research by eliminating the barriers to finding participants. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.